Welcome to the Collections by Michelle Brown Show, a show about people living between the lines, standing boldly in the crosshairs of their intersectionality as they create change. This episode is brought to you in partnership with the Center for Peace Counseling and Holistic Healing Services.
Welcome to Collections by Michelle Brown. I'm your host, Michelle Brown. Each week, we'll be talking with people living between the lines, standing boldly in the crosshairs of their intersectionality and creating change. After months of watching our children learn virtually or homeschooling them, our kids are returning to the classroom. But what will education look like? Even before the pandemic, many parents were questioning the quality of education, especially in public schools. Was the focus on teaching to the test failing our children? Were standard lesson plans keeping children from being able to think critically? Were their minds being influenced by media images that limit the ability to be empathetic, compassionate, and communicate? Critterkin is the brainchild of multimedia storyteller Jenna Ball, who has 25 years of professional writing and editing experience, 15 years designing and teaching online courses, and 13 years working on immersive learning environments in 3D worlds. Jenna has spent 12 years working as the creative director for the Critterkin Coalition. The Critterkin Coalition is a community composed of creative professionals, educators, parents, community members, businesses, and organizations that understand education is a lived experience extending far beyond the classroom. The mission is to make emotional intelligence a priority and help each child discover, develop, and share their unique interests and abilities. Of all the things learned from working on Critterkin these past years is that it takes a global community to raise our kids. Jenna returns to Collection by Michelle Brown to talk about the 7 parts of Critterkin, including books, ongoing projects, online classes, and teacher-parent workshops. Jenna, welcome back to Collections by Michelle Brown.
Well, Jenna, welcome back to Collections by Michelle Brown. You know, last time we were talking, we talked about so much, but we touched on something that I know is near and dear to your heart, and that's Critterkin. So can you remind us what Critterkin is about?
Sure. So Critterkin is a word I made up. And if you break it apart, critter means animals and kin means family. So you mash
them
all together.
That's what we're
doing. And so it means animal family. So I was intrigued by how, when I was volunteering at the local SPCA, I was intrigued by how particularly dogs and children like bonded and helped each other, you know. And so I originally wrote a very short story that I was reading in schools. And the more I was in the schools, the more topics and ideas and stories came to mind, which made me create the Critterkin Pack, which is a group of mixed breed goofy dogs who each have an issue or a challenge to face. So, for example, one of them uses a wheelchair, so he's different. Another one is really bossy, and nobody likes him because he's such a smart ass. Another one has to deal with bullies. Another one the latest one, which is the one I'm most proud of, has to deal with perfectionism. And that came up because I was in a classroom and drawing dogs with kids, and the kids kept saying that their drawings were ugly and stupid and bad, and mine's not perfect like yours. Mm. And this is happening across the United States, in Australia, in China, so it's not any one country. So I finally, you know, got it through my head and said, what do you guys think not perfect means, you know? And I got a list of 53 adjectives that will knock you over. So someone who is not perfect is dirty, stupid, bad, dumb, ugly, miserable, and a loser. And I mean, I could go on. But, I mean, those 10 right there just, I mean, the teachers were crying. My mouth was, you know, hanging open, and I was completely blown away. And I said, you guys, well, that's not true. And, of course, you know, you do what adults do, and you give them all the reasons nobody's perfect. And they said, yeah, no, we agree, Miss Jenna. And then I came back the next week, and I said, so what did we decide not perfect means? Stupid, bad, ugly, mess up, dirty. It's like, oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm. So why do they think that? That became my next big question. I went after it like a dog with a bone because, I mean, these are eight-year-olds. Nobody should think they need to be perfect. And the reason is that's how our education system operates. It's graded, and so it's in their mind, if you get an A, you're better than the person that got the B or the C. Mm-hmm. And you compare yourself to your classmates, both you know, in how you look, but also how you perform. You compete. And a lot of kids learn that how they perform is more important than who they are and what they do. And they become afraid to make mistakes because a mistake means failure. You won't get an A. And so as soon as I got that, I finally understood that, then I went after the neuroscience, because neuroscience tells us that intellectual learning and memories are not separate from the emotions. They are woven together in our minds. That's how our brains work. So children who are unhappy, angry, sad, hungry, any of those things can't learn well because their brains shut down. So that all made perfect sense to me. And I thought, how am I going to teach these kids that they don't have to be perfect? I need to help them understand their emotions are okay and that we all make mistakes, and that's how we learn, all those things you know, you would hope to teach children in a socially emotional way. So I wrote the book, The Not Perfect Hat Club, and it's about go ahead.
You know, Jenna, I mean, there's a couple of things that came to mind. First of all, critter care makes perfect sense because anyone who's had a pet, they are just a pet. They are a member and a part of
absolutely.
Of your family. But you know, one of the things that you were talking about, the neuroscience, you know, if you meet people who have never had a pet, you know,
That's a great point, yeah.
But sometimes if you meet someone who's mean to a pet, often you'll see that later on they become an abusive person. So that connection that you made, not only that, you know, our pets are part of our family, but what a perfect mirror of what we can be. Because when somebody truly loves an animal and is empathetic to an animal, they are a great person. So, I mean, that whole connection is just, like, phenomenal.
Well, it was, you know, I'd like to take credit for it. I mean, because I grew up with pets and, you know, dogs and cats and hamsters and turtles and everything. So I've always loved animals. But I have to say it was the children who taught me and just watching them. Because I think children, well, I know we've been able to prove that children are born inherently empathetic and that the emotional centers of our brain are kind of like our language center. And if we don't give them the chance to practice, it kind of atrophies, right? So if we were never exposed to language, we probably wouldn't speak or read very well. And if we're not exposed to social-emotional learning, then we probably won't become empathic or caring or compassionate or any of those things we want kids to be. So it's become a very big deal for me. Mm-hmm. And, well, you know, because you write your own books, aren't the animals the way into a child's heart?
Exactly.
It's the way, yes, because children will not, like if I tried to talk about bullying between children, they would shut down because it's too close mm-hmm. to home and there are other children watching them. But if we do it through the story of a dog, you know, who's bullied because of how he looks and all that, then they can relate and they can talk about it. And it's just far enough away from them for them to feel comfortable, but also care. They care about the dog. So, I mean, I know because your books do the same thing. I mean, it's the way into a child's heart to make it safe to explore these feelings.
And
so
you
that's
know how
the other big...
How they don't allow you, because I know when I was shooting my book, and I have one of them about bullying, and at first when you talked about it, everybody was tough. You know, I wouldn't let anybody do that to me. I'm tough, you know.
Right.
Nobody, you know, I don't, you know, they always tough people. But like you said, as we're reading the story and they're talking about this little dog being bullied because he's a little different. And, you know, then it was like you said, they were able to let down that machismo veneer that they had to have it. I'm tough and I'm not going to let anybody do anything to me. But also to say, not only that they've been bullied, but also if they saw it, they'd stop.
And what do they do about it? How do they handle it? We don't teach them how to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, I think that's really, really important. It's not just what you felt, it's how do you deal with the feelings. And a lot of bullying programs now kind of pivot and discuss why a bully would do something like that, but also why and what would a bystander do? You know, like, why are you quiet if you're watching this? Why aren't you saying anything? Are you afraid, or do you think it's funny, or what, you know? And kids really need to work through those feelings, you know? We need to give them permission to do that. And I think the way, I mean, from my experience so far, is a combination of the story, because stories are cathartic. Stories give us a way to explore what we're experiencing and work through it. We get to watch the dogs work through it. And then you need to give them also an opportunity to be creative and express what they learn through it, through the story, in their own way. So everybody's picture will be a little bit different. Everybody's retelling of the story will be different, and that's good because you're internalizing it. And then the final step for me is some kind of hands-on, real-world activity that allows them to apply what they learned from the story to a real situation. So I'll give you an example. We draw, in most of my classes, we draw dogs who are actually waiting to be adopted. So I'll go to a local animal shelter, and I'll take pictures, and I'll bring them in the classroom, and I'll say, this is Sophie, and this is Max, and this is, and they're all, Mr. Stubbs was one of my favorite ones, he was a bulldog. Anyway, and they're waiting for home, so let's draw their picture and tell their stories to help them get adopted. And the kids love that, of course. So we learn how to draw the dog, which is good for eye-hand coordination, all that kind of thing, and then we each write a story, and the shelter puts it up on the dog's kennel to help them get adopted. Now, how good does that feel? How good does the kid feel when the dog that they help save, you know, gets adopted? I love that. That's what I mean by project-based learning. You know, it's something that, that gives kids a chance to practice what they learned in the story. You know, there's all different things we tried, like the Not Perfect Hat Club. We made hats and we sold them. And the reason we sold them was because kids learn, you know, how much does fabric cost? How do you sew? How do you make a sign, a poster to sell a hat? How much should a hat cost? You know, all of that. And then they got to donate the money that they raised from making and selling the hats to the local animal shelter. So, again, they got to see the effects of what they'd done. I love that. It's just like that's Critican in a nutshell right there.
I mean, really. I mean, that whole – because often, you know, let's face it, a lot of these kids, they're not getting it at home. They're not often seeing it in the media. I know I saw recently, I don't know what it was, but I remember, and I don't even know what program it was on, but there was something, and they showed this kid who had gotten bullied, and he was at home, and they showed the mother's response was to take a sock and fill it with rocks and say, we're going back up there, you know. And
Oh dear.
What? You know, but
this is not good.
Exactly. But we know that a lot of kids come from a home where maybe, you know, it's like, okay, well, be tough, or they don't have time. The parents right. don't have time to sit there and do that. And it seems like, you know, I can recall, you know, having adults who spent time with me, who had my back, yes. who read me. And then we went to the right. generation of adults who are busy, work, 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 achieve, achieve, achieve. And the children are being minded by the television or whatever.
Yes. Or another screen, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to be able, but like what you're saying is like that natural empathy is still there. It's just like you have
yes.
developed a different way.
Yes,
it's
absolutely.
Like a nerve. Like a muscle.
It's inherent in us. It's like a muscle
mm-hmm.
that needs to be used.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other thing that I'll say, and I think it's important to say, is two things. One, we have a whole generation that's been raised with this industrialized education model. So the only education they've known is the same thing we're trying to undo. You know, they think that if their kid isn't getting an A, there's something wrong with them. Nobody is telling them that each child is different. Each child needs to be, you know, nurtured and developed and helped to find his or her gift. No, you're supposed to pass the test. What's wrong with you? So that's one problem. The other problem is that our economy right now is so messed up that both parents have to work to be able to survive. So mm-hmm. I don't think it's anybody's fault per se, but the pandemic has called all this into question in the worst possible way. You know, it's unsafe to send your kids to school. Well, what do you do with them?
Mm-hmm.
And even the schools, there's some in North Carolina, they're just scrambling, but they're doing the best they can to get kids online to teach them that way. Well, even those teachers don't know what to do. How do they take their lecture-based lessons and transfer them onto a computer? How can you expect an 8-year-old to sit in front of a computer for 8 hours a day? That ain't going to happen. So, it's a unique and wonderful opportunity to start to apply some of the Critiquin principles to activities, books, stories, online programs that we can do, both individually and across the country. I mean, we don't have to be just in one state or even one city. We can connect with people around the world. I've done that. So what if we had, you know, Critiquin programs where teachers connected their classroom, well, their kids, let's say, right now, with other kids around the world? Why not? And if they could read the same stories and learn with each other, I mean, to me, that's a perfect opportunity and a great way to use online learning tools. But here we are still trying to get the same old lectures
mm-hmm.
and see if we can put it on the computer and have the kids sit in front of the computer. No, it's just not going to work.
So, you know,
I see it as a wonderful opportunity.
I mean, yeah, well, because like people often want to talk about, you know, the downside of what we're going through now. But it is also that opportunity because, like more people, I mean, are turning to learning on school or supplementing what they're learning in the classroom with what's online. But like you said, what is that content? If we're just shoveling out the same old stuff, then
isn't working.
It's not working, you know. But here's what it could be a moment of great opportunity.
That's the way I see it, and that's why I'm going to jump a little bit here to the Critiquin Coalition because
let's take a break and then. When we come back, let's talk about the Critiquin Coalition. So we'll be right there.
All right.
This episode of Collections by Michelle Brown is brought to you in partnership with the Center for Peace Counseling and Holistic Healing Services, bringing balance to your mind, body, and spirit. For more information or to schedule an appointment, visit the center at thecenterforpeacellc.com.
We're back here on Collections by Michelle Brown. We're talking again with Jenna Ball. Jenna, okay, we've talked about what criticisms do. What are the core principles? And then about the coalition. Can you share that?
Yeah, so I've been doing criticism now for almost 12 years, and I've been in literally hundreds of classrooms around the world, especially through video, you know, live video chats and things. I run an international program with one of my books that had 600 schools in 16 countries. And if there's one thing that I learned the hard way, it's there's only one of me. And while criticism is a wonderful thing.
We can clone you.
No. And in fact, one of me is enough for the world. So, but one of the marvelous things that doing the international program taught me was how creative and innovative teachers are if you give them a chance, you know? So 600 schools, we had a lot of people, and they would just take the materials that I provided each week, and they ran with it. And the kids and the teachers came up with stuff I would never have thought of. Like, they made a rap song, okay? They got together, four of them got together, and they sang the Maori, I think it's the Maori people in New Zealand, like there's a fight song that they, and they sang that together. And I was like, where did you come up with, they were wonderful. And so that made me think, okay, well, stop thinking about me as an individual and think about what needs to happen for this to be embraced by a lot more people. And, it was people like yourself, who's another author, who gets it, which you clearly do. I mean, you know. But the wonderful thing about, like, if you were in the coalition, is that your stories and your books and your way of presenting things are equally valid and equally important for kids. You know, they don't need just one person. They need dozens. And so wouldn't it be wonderful if we could include other creative professionals? So authors, musicians, public speakers, dance instructors. I mean, think of all the different people we could bring in who would contribute material that the kids could learn from, right? So to me, that's the first step. The other piece is we need to create a business model that benefits everybody. So, you know, we can sell books, we can do author readings, we can have speaking engagements, we can sell t-shirts and hats and all the things, and the online classes, we could sell those. But I think that the bigger opportunity is with larger organizations who understand that education needs to shift and are willing to commit their time and energy and resources, i.e. money, to helping us do that. So we get together a group of people who are, you know, from each of these disciplines who are committed to this. Like, I'm just not really good at writing grant proposals, and I don't want to do it. And I suck at bookkeeping. So, I mean, let the people who are really good at that kind of thing do it, you know? And so we get a group of people who are good at each of these things, and then we plot out a way to make a profitable, child-centered form of education that's available, and we can sell it, we can do all, but everybody benefits, not just the kids, and not just the parents, and not just just me. I mean, everybody has a piece of the pie, and that's healthy profit-making, I think. Mm-hmm. So,
big conglomerate, what we're doing is not only taking care of our kids, but finding a way so that it's sustainable, because, you know, that's real. We have to eat. And
that's
I think that a lot of people don't want to. They'll think about that, and then they'll go, like, I'm just being an idealist, and it wouldn't work, and how would I feed my family? Okay, all right, these are ways, and you're doing it in a way that's not, you know, sorry, Digger, it's not dog eat dog. It's not part of the rat race, but you're doing something that's holistic, and yes. lifting a community of educators and families and kids up at the same time.
Right. And, you know, if we each, I mean, I know this from working with Substack or even some of the musicians I have collaborated with who, you know, they don't make a lot of money off of something like, you know, Spotify or SoundCloud or whatever they put their songs, but they make a little bit. And if each person puts in just a little bit, then, you know, eventually we get big enough that everybody can benefit, right?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that is super important to me is that critter can walk its talk. And I learned this from Patagonia because the Patagonia people are committed to recycling and taking care of the planet and all that. And mm-hmm. and for Critican to walk its talk, it means that it's story-driven, science-based, project-based learning, but that you know, tackles all the different tough topics that we need to talk about. Come on, we need to talk about racism. We need to talk about perfectionism. We need to talk about the planet, you know. But together, we explore and interpret these topics in a way that strengthens kids' EQ, emotional intelligence, as well as their IQ, right? And that we inherit in everything we do is the awareness that we're all in, you know, we're all connected. We're all interconnected. That's the word I want. We're all interconnected and interdependent. So we're aware of that all the time. So whatever I choose to do or say impacts you, which in turn impacts your network, which in turn impacts you. So just the awareness that all life is interconnected, interdependent will help our kids grow into, I think, healthy, happy adults who are responsible and understand that they have a responsibility to others and to the planet. So that's kind of like the foundation. That's a big, I don't know, called mission statement.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in some way, you know how they say it takes a village to raise a child.
Yes.
Critican is developing that village. And if you have a village, everybody has a role that they come. Everybody isn't.
Thank you. Yes.
Some people are cleaning. Some people are taking care of the kids. Some people are planting. So everyone brings what they have to the critican, but the about our kids. And this is the village.
I am. You know, I've met some really. It's rare, but I've met some really unique people, like the guy who founded Crayola, who really understood that he had an active responsibility. And I say active because he's very proactive about his own outreach. But, you know, that he, just because he's an adult doesn't mean he doesn't, you know, have an obligation to help kids. You know, and that he's responsible, we're all responsible as a global community for helping our kids grow up and to be decent people, right? And so if, I think it's beneficial to both businesses and organizations and the kids, if the kids get a chance to learn their basic life skills, which include emotional intelligence, you know, in the world. So if organizations are willing to help kids, mentor kids, I say it takes a global community to raise our children.
mm-hmm.
And wouldn't it be lovely if people saw it like that and felt like that, like that was a good thing for them too. Have you ever been in the presence of children that you didn't come away feeling better?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I am so grateful every time I get a chance to be with kids because I get to just be myself. I can be goofy and silly and they'll ask me questions I would never have thought of, right? And so I just feel joyful when I'm done visiting with them.
And
they,
you know,
are a gift to us.
When you're with a child, especially if you see that they're whatever, going through something, and you spend time with them, and they give you that smile.
Yeah.
I
know exactly what you're talking about.
You smile back at them. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
You know, there's not, I mean, talk about rich beyond measure. I mean, there's something about when you see a child, especially if it's that little shy peek around the corner at you and smile.
Right.
It's like, wow.
Well, and I feel like that they're touching that little child in me that never, thank goodness, never really grew up. You know, like it's okay to be little Jenna again. It's okay to laugh and be silly and giggle. And I feel like they're seeing that in me. I don't know how they do it, but they do it. You know, it's so wonderful. I love being around kids.
Mm-hmm.
I usually catch a cold, but I love being around them.
Gosh. You know, they can make you be a better person. They can make you feel good. They can make you give of yourself something that you didn't think that you had in you to give. You know, like I said, sometimes they'll listen with you with such rapt attention. And they get it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Which is why I think dogs are so, I have this theory about dogs and a whole mythology I've developed about dogs. But the basic myth is that dogs were once wolves, and Great Gray Mother Wolf called all her wolves together and said, I need some volunteers to go and straighten those dumb human beings out. they're messing up out there, right? And so who wants to go and be a dog, you know? So all of our dogs that we have now are, you know, volunteers to help remind us of the love we tend to forget. You know, we get caught up in our wars and our politics and our money-making schemes and all that gobbledygook. But dogs are a direct reminder of that love. Like, it's unconditional. And that's why I think kids respond to them so well. But also, it's important to keep kids connected to animals so they never lose that love. That's my personal.
Well, you know, I'm going to tell you. The fact that we had an occupant in the White House who had no pets, I mean, that's just that said volumes about it. And then if you look like his predecessor, one of the first things that Obama said was, okay, girls should get that dog, you know.
Yeah.
And then they got a second dog. And you see pictures of him running with the dog, and it was beautiful. And then the current occupant who had a rescue, I mean, he had these dogs that he clearly loved. I mean, there's something about, I mean, you can keep going back, and there's something about, like you said, that if you don't have that empathy, if I don't see that sort of says volumes to me about it. Even if, you know, when I see someone who's with that animal and it's like, particularly this dog, and, you know, dogs know, I mean, and I'm going to tell you too, cats know too. You know, if they don't like you, there's a reason. You know, if a dog or something, they'll give you that side eye. But they also know how to go out, and often they'll go find the kid, and they help you remain. You know, when you're throwing the ball back and forth to the dog or playing with them, you're a kid again.
Yep. Oh, yeah. And there are other animals that do that, too. I experienced something similar, although you have to be more careful with horses and cows. Mm-hmm. And cows, oddly enough, my cats would probably say that they are just as good or better than the dogs, but...
Oh, but of course. I'm not biased. You're sitting here looking at me, but of course they are.
Yeah, my 20-pounder is laying on my desk like, you're talking about dogs again, you know? I need to write a Criticon series about the cats, but unfortunately the next book coming out is about another dog. So.
Well, I've got one.
I'll get
I've
to
got
it.
One in the works about a cat, so, you know. We'll work together on that, you know.
Okay,
but,
this
you know,
is good.
Often, and, you know, and that's the other thing that when you stop and you think about it, it's like how expressive they are. You know, like we rely so much on our words. But a dog can, you know, put his paw on you, and it's like, okay, I feel better. You know, the cats have a way of, like, giving you that headbutt. And, you know, okay,
right.
Well, you love me. You know, I know a woman who raises horses in Texas, and she talked about how there's some ways when she'll come out, and the horse has a way of knowing to sort of come up to her and, you know, give it nuzzle and stuff, and how suddenly the troubles melt away.
Oh, yeah. I have to tell you about this wonderful couple. They're both child psychologists, and they specialize in childhood trauma. And they opened a center in New Jersey? I think, no, Rhode Island, sorry, in Rhode Island, and they do therapy with horses. So they actually have therapy horses. And when I was talking to them about their horses the other day, the husband said, he's, you know, we don't hire anybody here until the horse approves of him or her. I said, excuse me? And he said, you know, horses are extremely empathic. They kind of have to be because they're prey animals, you know. And so they're real skittish. They're aware of their surroundings and all that. And when they perceive a new person in their environment, they react to them. I mean, they'll sniff them, they'll touch them, they'll walk around them, and they'll let us know if they don't think it's a good person. But apparently this is very effective therapy because the kids respond to being able to touch a big animal, you know, that cares mm-hmm. about them.
You know,
I want to go up and visit.
Yeah, Kudokin is a lot about emotional intelligence.
Yes.
Okay, do you feel that animals have mastered that?
So, yeah. I think that's a really good question. I think that because of our intellectualization of everything, that we have to process and work things out, even our emotions, like we have to identify them, we have to name them, we have to work through, you know, we have made emotions complicated. But I think that animals are inherently in a state of love, and that they communicate through visuals. Now, you can, I mean, I know animal communicators, and they can communicate, and they will communicate with you. But it's usually in pictures, and it's usually an emotional thing, as opposed to, like, they don't send words, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a different kind, and it's more, I would say it's more heart-centered just inherently, because they don't have the language we have. Mm-hmm. So are they masters? Heck yeah. But haven't you, be honest now, haven't you met some animals that are just, like, evolved?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is not a cat. That is a princess from Egypt or whatever, you know, because they can, mm-hmm. and then you get the ones that are kind of like, yeah, well, I'm a cat, you know, and it's fine just to be a cat. But there are animals who are really wise. Which makes me think that, you know, there's an evolution amongst the animals, too, you know? That's my airy fairy theory.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you know, and in that, you know, I like to see, we were at your park over the weekend, and here were some people with these two little dogs in a stroller, and it was, and part of me was like, get them out the stroller and let them just be out.
They had the dogs in a stroller?
In a stroller.
What?
You know, and I'm like, you know, and you could see that the dogs, their heads were like turning around, like, I want to run and play.
Of course, yeah.
Like, you know, we're trying to make the dogs, they were trying to make dogs sometimes be like surrogate children, but then they want
yes.
to stop children from being children. They want them to be little adults.
Yes.
And, you know,
that's a good observation, yeah, it's true.
Mm-hmm. And it's so like, no, yeah. How, you know, how do we recognize what we're doing? I mean, and what is the react, when you go in someplace and you start to, just a general school when you're presenting about that, and you start to talk about emotional intelligence, is there a receptivity from educators or people who are in it who also go like, you know, I'd love to do that, but you know what? We have to teach to the test.
That has been my experience. Now, I will tell you, I have 10,000 educators who follow me on Twitter, and I have great relationships with them. I've visited with many of them, and they are not the problem. The problem is the educational institution that says you have to teach only this way. And I have had people tell me that it's their job to say no to people like me. Mm. And I said, what in the heck are you talking about? He says, you know, you people want to come in here and teach kindness and compassion. He said, that's taking away from the time we need to teach our kids to take their tests. And that's a soft skill they don't need. I mean, I'm quoting this guy. Mm. And it's not unusual. But that's the institution. That you got to understand how much money and time is invested in doing it this way. It's a money-making endeavor, and the kids are the victims of it, frankly. So, no, there isn't a lot of receptivity. It's one of the reasons I set Critiquin aside for a little while and thought, you know, until I can see a way forward, like I don't want to be beating my head against the education system. I'm not getting anywhere. So, yeah, I thought I'm tired and I've been doing this, you know, a long time. Let me just step back for a little while and see, you know, where can I find my own peace and joy again? Because Critiquin was a joy to create. It's when I tried to start to sell it to people, you know, who were not interested at all, that it became a pain in the rear. So I've been away now for a couple of years. And I can say, you know, coming back now that I think that it's just, trying to change a massive institution is not, especially just one person, is not the way to do it, you know? Mm-hmm. Who are the people who have access to the children, who care the most about the children? Who are they?
Besides,
not the principals. It's not the principals. It's not, the teachers care, but their jobs are at stake if they change things, right? So who is it? It's the families. It's the parents. It's the grandparents, it's the people who have to live with the results of this, you know? And oddly enough, and I love this piece of it, because I have a good friend who works for Adobe, and they've done a lot of studies about this, and companies like Google and Intel and SAS and Red Hat, they're all upset because they can't find find and hire people who are emotionally intelligent. And to them, that means that they're open to innovation, that they are willing to learn, that they don't think in silos, and that they're not afraid to make mistakes. Those are all signs of emotional intelligence. And the children, well, the young adults that we are graduating from college do not have any of those things. They're afraid to make mistakes. They think that a measure of their success is their grades. And when you drop them into a new job that may require them to learn something new, they're kind of lost. But according to my friend at Adobe, 60% of the jobs these kids will have not even been invented yet. So don't they need to be able to be flexible, willing to learn, willing to collaborate, to think outside the box, all those things that we don't teach them? So I'm finding that there's a lot more receptivity in the marketplace businesses, you know, because they need to hire people who can do these things. And they're saying, well, what can we do to help? Right? So what if they, you know, took part in making classes and bringing kids in to let them do internships and stuff? Again, I'm just brainstorming here. But if they were part of the coalition, you know, that's saying, you know, we'll give money to help kids become better adults. I think that's a really positive thing. So that's sort of where I am right now. I'm looking for partners in the coalition who will help me with these, not just the education piece. I mean, I'm, you know, connected to a lot of people like yourself who would contribute books and creative stuff. That's good. But then who are the people in the real world who will help us give kids something to do? You know, we teach them social, emotional skills, and where are they going to apply it? Can they come and work at your bank? can they come down to the animal shelter? What can the businesses and organizations outside of schools do to help with this? And then what can the parents do? I'm hoping parents will get mad about this and raise bloody hell, because if it was my kid and my kid wasn't learning any of this, I'd be mad. You know, but how can we educate parents about what they should be advocating for their children? You know, parents should be saying, hey, you know, why isn't my kid learning how to handle bullies? How come my kid somebody doesn't teach them how to have like mindfulness meditation so that when they get upset, they know how to handle their emotions. What are you guys doing in school with my kids, right? That's what I want. I want parents and families to get upset enough to demand change, because it will happen if they demand it, you know. Don't teach my kid to just have a stiff upper lip and get an A. Who cares about the A? What did he learn from that, you know? And what is his special skill? What is his special gift? How can we empower my child to be the best that he can be? Those are the kind of questions I want parents to start to ask and get excited about.
Mm-hmm.
And if criticism can be the wedge, you know, because nobody's going to do anything unless it's fun and entertaining, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's face it, people don't do things unless it's, you know, nobody wants to be beaten over the head with something. They want to have fun. And criticism mm-hmm. is fun. And it's fun not just for kids. It's fun for parents, too. So if we can make it fun and engaging,
mm-hmm.
then maybe things will change.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a break. And because I've got something going through my head that I want to talk about and give it, you know, time to go through. So we'll be right back.
Collections by Michelle Brown airs every Thursday at 7 p.m. You can subscribe now and listen to the podcast on Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud. Be sure to like the Collections by Michelle Brown Facebook page and mark your calendar so you never miss an episode.
On Collections by Michelle Brown, and we're talking with Jenna Ball not only about Critterkin, but we've been talking a lot about emotional intelligence. And you know, Jenna, as I was thinking, a lot of the parents, a lot of teachers have to teach to the test. A lot of parents were raised being taught to the test. We have a lot of people in our world who, you know, are looking at, you know, oh, they have to be productive. They have to go do this and do that. But, you know, I remember in the early 2000s, going and hearing Richard Florida talk. And he had written this book about the rise of the creative class. And one of the things he was talking about is like, you know, about how if it was going to be a new world, we had to have creativity. You know, it's not about just going and making raw materials and making widgets, you know. But one
right.
of the things that found is like we've had a couple of generations to where, you know, there was some where it was like graduate from high school, maybe you went to college, maybe you went right into the factory and you got a job and you made this money. And then you had all these things and you told your kids what you have to do is go to college so you can get this good job and make these things. So we've got a couple of three generations, maybe even more than that generation, but that's been the mindset. That's how they sort of got in to teach to the test so they can pass and they can go and do that. But by stifling the emotional intelligence, we've stifled a great deal of the creativity that these companies are talking about. I mean, those future workers, the jobs that haven't even been developed, they need creative minds.
Yes, they do.
People who can look around and sort of see, you know, we need to care about the earth. We need to care about animals. We need to care about one another. And this is something that will do that and provide jobs. So it seems to me, how do we break these generations of not only teaching to the test, but educating so you can go and get a quote-unquote job? And if anything, this pandemic has shown us that those quote-unquote jobs aren't there. We need to be creative.
And even if they're there, they pay so little you can't survive on them, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Correct. it's, I think, oddly enough, I mean, I don't like it, but I think that the pandemic is breaking us. Because the reason everybody thought that you should, you know, graduate from high school and then go to college and so you can get a good job is because that's the story we were sold. And it enabled colleges to make a lot of money. You know, there's a lot of money in college education. But what's happening now, and not just the education itself, but the loans that kids take out to be able to get through college, right? And so they're getting to the end of this process, and there are no jobs. And they have huge student debt, and they're crashing and burning. They have no future. They can't afford a home, never mind, I mean, an apartment, never mind a home. And they don't see a way forward. And so I think that some of that needs to just stop, period. I mean, I really love Elizabeth Warren's view of the situation. You know, we have to forgive student debt because otherwise we're killing our next generation. But I also think that if we would begin to value what each person brings to a job and encourage them to grow and develop their unique skills, because everybody has something unique that they bring to the table, whether or not they're hired to be suppose you're hired to be an engineer, or like myself, I was hired at a pharmaceutical agency to be a writer, to write about pharmaceutical products, you know, that are being sold. But had that employer been open to everything else that I could do, like I'm a very good writer, but I'm also trained in illustration. I have a lot of experience with social media. I really enjoy teaching people. I could have done online classes for them. I've done podcasts. I could have done that. So if they had been open to what I wanted to develop in myself, like I would get excited about it. I love the idea of doing a podcast. Then I think that it would benefit the company if they're open to it. You know, like let people evolve their jobs. Like I would never say to my employer, I won't be a writer. You hired me to write. Okay, that's fine. But what else can I do? And let me grow and develop and become better at a lot of different things that can then benefit the company, right?
Uh-huh.
So that's one solution. The other solution that you brought up, and I don't really know the answer yet, but I see it starting to happen. And I only learned about this because of publishing. You know, when I started to publish my books, I was with a regular, quote unquote, regular publisher. I had an agent, and they didn't do anything. They published it, but they didn't do anything. And so I was left to do all the marketing and promotion and all. And, you know, I just written a book. I was tired. I didn't want to do all that. So I think the publishing industry is just one example, but it's broken. And so I went and started self-publishing. If I was going to have to do all the marketing, I wanted to keep the profits, right? And then I started meeting other authors whom I liked and respected tremendously, you know, and that's where part of my idea for the coalition came together, because I thought, you know, if I could work with Michelle and we could build a little enclave over here that's made up of authors who create beautiful books and illustrations and paintings and stuff that teach social emotional learning, we don't need the publishing houses. We can sell it ourselves. That's sort of my that's kind of like my microcosm. And I think that because children, you know, children are so inventive in this regard. If given half the chance, you know, what would you like to do with this? What can you see you would like, you know, what would you like to try? The kids are the ones who came up with making hats. I didn't come up with that. You know, and they went home and brought in sewing machines and they bought felt and they priced out the cost of thread, and I mean, they were amazing, and they sold $800 worth of hats. So, and I'll tell you something else. That class was a special ed class too. So don't ever tell me special ed kids can't do things. So anyway,
they were really special. They
weren't. Oh my goodness! Special. I love those kids. So my point is that I think that before we can really, really answer that, we need to let children begin to find out who they really are. Like, what really floats your boat? What gets you excited? Because there are going to be people who love to do math, and there are going to be kids that love to do engineering, and there are people that, you know, all the things that I hate to do, but they love it, you know? But let them find it, and then let's encourage and support them moving forward. Some will start their own businesses. Some will go into big corporations and try to make change there. But we need to be open to that and not be afraid of change or think that the ultimate goal is to make money. Because in the end, it's not. You know, the ultimate goal is to become better human beings and save the planet at this point, you know. I think we've really gotten off track as a race. We need to step back a little bit and say, you know, what are we here to do? It's certainly not to cut down forests and you know, build dams and all the things that we've done, you know. We're here to learn how to be better human beings. And that's, I know it's a big airy fairy thing to say, but that's what I believe.
And, you know, isn't it also, I mean, as I was writing the children's book, which is different from everything else I've been, it made me like sometimes think. And I think that this would be a wonderful opportunity to authors who wanted to be involved and doing it, because sometimes I would have to think and going like, that's not how a child would relate to it or how a dog would relate to it. You know, that's me being a grown-up, you know.
But look what you were doing. You were empathizing, and that's a great skill. I mean, I teach all my kids how to write stories, not because I, you know, think that they're all going to become authors, but because it's so important to know what's going on in their own head. What is the story you're telling in your own head? Write it down so you can look at it, and then change it if you don't like it. But we don't teach children to be that self-aware. We don't teach them to work out their emotions in a story format. I think, you know, and there are people who do that through, I mean, I do it through writing. The people who do it through painting, people who do it through music, and people who do it through building things, for goodness sake. Okay, that's all right. Do it.
Yeah, you know, and if you were writing, and, you know, I could say, if you had people who are in touch with kids and they're thinking that way, they're growing too. And,
yes,
and then as
thank
a
you.
Child sees a
thank
book
you.
About something small in their mind, like, oh, that could never happen. And here, Miss Jenna comes with this book, and she's got a dog who's an engineer. They're going like, yeah, I can do that. You know, I can tackle that problem.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think another real huge problem with our education system, and this just has to change, is we assume that here are these adults, these know-all, these experts who are imparting wisdom to children. And what we forget, and we mustn't forget ever again, is that children have as much to teach us as adults as we have to teach them. And that's where the exchange has been forgotten. And that's why you and I respond just like, oh, my gosh, I remember. Oh, it's so wonderful to be a kid, you know. That needs to happen all the time. A teacher is not better than a student. They're just a little farther along in certain ways, you know. And so I always try to think of myself as a guide on the side, not somebody who's, you know, imparting information or wisdom. It brings tears to my eyes. You know, once I've told my story and I start asking kids questions, you know, well, what did you think? And how do you know, if you were this dog, what would you do? And it, I just wait with kind of just this eager anticipation to see what they may come up with, because they have something to teach me. I have never been in a classroom that the kids haven't taught me something, ever. And that, you know, we forget that. We mustn't forget that. Kids are still awfully close to spirit, remember? So they've got less walls and less what I call, you know, mud all over themselves energetically. You know, they're closer. They remember. They're more in tune to their heart. And if adults would pay attention, they get some of that back. That's me being a little
And to recognize that you don't know it all, I know that one time when I was reading my book and I had like a dog was barking, and there was one group and a teacher was just like, shush, shut up, be quiet. And I said, okay, so what does it sound like when dogs bark? And so they just had a ball doing it. I said, okay, this is what you're going to be. You're my dog pound. And when I get to that point, I'm going to punch you with you guys. And you know what?
Yeah.
A ball.
Yeah, oh yeah. I build, someday let's do a reading together, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it would be really fun. I build that into my stories. So before I even start, I say, do you guys like to make noise? And of course they love to make noise, right? And I say, okay, so when you hear words in groups of three, can you repeat after me? And so I'll give them examples. Yes, yes, yes. And, of course, they scream back at me, yes, yes, and no, no, no. And so we go through a few of these things, and I say, okay, now we're going to make it a little harder, okay? Can we say no, no, no and sound sad and quiet? So no, no, no. How about no, 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 angry? No, no, no. And so we practice the emotional stuff in the sound.
Uh-huh.
And so when we get to those parts in the story, they're right there with me, you know. The dog says, yes, 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 and they're like, yes, yes, yes. And so, I mean, it's good for their body, but I also think it's good for them to be in tune with the emotion that's being conveyed in the story. So I'm right there with you.
Uh-huh.
I think it's, yeah.
And, you know, the thing,
wonderful.
And like you were saying, you know, how their teacher, like, was trying to wrangle them to be the perfect little audience, and they tended up being
exactly that's it. Yeah, good
audience. And even
good,
afterwards,
good.
She was like, "Wow, they were. I mean, that was just great." She said, and she's like, "You know, I should figure out a way to engage them in what we're doing in the classroom, because she'd have them come, they sit in their seats, they sit quietly, they do all this, and they weren't giving back to her." And she said,
of course.
I want them to be engaged and give back. And
yes.
Like, yeah. You
so,
know?
Can you tell me what is the thing that you've learned, what's the most important lesson you've learned from reading to kids or being with them with your books?
I think that the biggest thing I've learned is that, you know, you talked about it allows me to be myself.
Right.
To give and to receive. You know, I'm sharing something with them, and it's not like I don't have to worry about being perfect, because they're happy to hear and they give me back something which I know only makes it better.
And also,
you know how we talk about when a kid smiles at you? After I finish and I know that, you know, they've participated, they've laughed, they told me what I did wrong, you know, they've helped me be better.
Yep.
When I walk out of that room, I'm at cloud nine.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
What is that?
I mean,
what is that expression? We lift each other up? Is that it? That's sort of how I feel. You know, like I've been lifted up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's not just one kid. It's not just me. It's not, you know, it's all of us. Like we lifted each other up to a better vibration or energy. Does that feel right?
Yeah. I mean, I have spoken before groups where afterwards I get like, you know, great applause and atta girls, but it doesn't give you that same
feel.
It really doesn't.
You know, I would love to record you sometime, and then, you know, when we have to give a presentation to quote-unquote adults about the importance of this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, and then we use, actually, you know, we tell them what you know, this is why this is important. That's only going to sink in intellectually, but if we then show them the children responding to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and say, see, this is what we're talking about. This is an emotional thing. It's not just an intellectual exercise. We want you to feel this. Don't you feel better listening to these kids? Look at their eyes. Look at Michelle's eyes. Look at the joy in the room. Don't you want to be part of that? Yeah, that's when you hook the adult, when they can be there and feel what the kids feel.
Exactly. You know, because really you can sit there and they can all nod and clap and everything. But then,
yep,
like you said, to go in with a group of kids and put it in action and they see it, you know.
Yep.
Like they're gonna want that. You know what I mean? It's like, I want
how
some
can
of
you
that.
Not?
Yeah, I want some
you
of
know,
that.
I was lucky enough to be asked to do a presentation at the Lucy Daniels Center, which is a school that teaches kids who learn differently. None of them have mental handicaps at all, but they just learn differently, you know? And so there's a lot of almost one-on-one teacher interaction with the kids, and the kids are given all the attention they need and everything. But they were doing a teacher training, and I got to present to 40 teachers in the area, and they came in looking so tired and so like, oh, God, we've got to sit through yet another training, you know, and then I've got to go to school tomorrow and teach. And I thought, you know what? Because I had this whole lecture and everything else planned out, and I thought, nope, I'm going to do exactly what I do with the kids and get them to bark and repeat after me and draw dogs and just be kids for an hour and a half. And at first they looked at me like I was insane. Who is this crazy person that we have in front of us here? And I said, you know, just be with me with this, okay? Be open to just experiencing it, because you guys could use a boost. And I want you to experience what the kids experience. So at first they thought it was, you know, them doing it for their kids. You know, okay, we'll do it for our kids. And then they got into it. And the whole room shifted. You know, they were so happy, and they were showing me their pictures, and they talked about how much fun it was to just be, not be told anything, to be. And I thought, you know, adults need this kind of thing too. I know we talk about it being for kids, but can you imagine reading your books for adults? I can.
Mm-hmm.
Why not?
I mean, really, I mean, it gives you these opportunities to do, you know, and especially if you go to kids. And I have read one of my books to some adults, and you can sort of tell there's some who are really, like, leaning in. And it's like, what's going to happen next?
Yeah.
In fact, that's what made me write my second children's book, because I had some adults who said, at the end of it, I just wanted to know what was going to happen to him if he goes to your
family,
you know.
Yeah, that's the greatest compliment you can be given right there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and that was really kind of, like you said, that's wonderful, especially, and when I finished the second one, and I had someone who read it, and they said, you know what, it was perfect. And he said, I felt good, you know, but we invested in that, you know.
I don't know. I guess I see people like you and I, and a lot of the musicians I'm working with, and the illustrators. I see it sort of as catalysts. You know, once people become more self-empowered and trust their own creativity and where their hearts are wanting them to go, we probably won't be as in the limelight, for lack of a better word. But right now, we need adults who will be that kind of, I don't know, holding up the torch kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to have fun. Work doesn't have to be miserable. It's okay to be creative. It's okay to make mistakes. So I think that's another piece of the coalition now that you're talking, you and I are talking, that I'd like to have.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like the coalition to.
Mm-hmm. And to have people within the coalition stretch, you know?
Yes.
Okay, stretch. Let's try something different. You know, the first time that I wrote poetry and then read it before people, I mean, I know people who were surprised, like, this isn't what we were expecting from you. But it was a different way of reaching out to them And then to have some of them go like, I felt that. I felt that.
Yeah, you're actually a very good poet.
Okay. I didn't expect
that.
I know. I know people go like, I didn't expect that. And, you know.
Right.
But to not only, because if we don't stretch, how are we going to show kids that it's okay to try and to do this? If each and every time we're doing, you know, we become, okay, we're talking about this and we want you to feel and be in touch with your emotions, and you're doing, you know, rote each time. Where if you say, you know, we're going to talk about it. And let me show you one way, because there's a lot of kids who might have, there's different ways of expressing it. So who knows? Maybe someone who is doing it one way, one time, will say, well, hey, I've decided to play the guitar, and today I'm going to play this song, and you tell me what it means. You know, so it's such a huge opportunity to be a catalyst for change, not only with the children, because, you know, I always say, you know, if I can get them when they're kids, yeah, I'll tell you.
Yes.
I used to do worm composting. And people were like, most of us would go like, worms in my house, eating my garbage. Oh, no.
So cool. So cool, though.
I started to take worm boxes to schools, show kids how it was, and they thought it was the coolest thing. And
it is the coolest thing.
Show them how to make a worm box. And guess what? Before you knew it, Mom, Dad, I want to have worms. I don't want to throw away our garbage. Can we compost? So sometimes, you know, show kids, and guess what? Even though we're talking about this kind of intelligence that maybe their parents have been like so, you know, raised to the test, raised to get a job, when their kid comes and says, hey, let's draw today. Maybe they'll say, well, you know what? Okay. You know, I'm not the best, but I'll give them a try. And they'll have those experiences where
grow. Yeah, that's, again, what we both know is that kids have as much to teach us as we can teach them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I don't know how to, I'm just getting started with this coalition thing, so any ideas that you or your listeners may have, about how to and who to bring together, you know? I'm open to talking to people.
Well, how do you see developing this dialogue? So if someone is out listening and they said, you know what, I think I'd like to be a part of this. I think I have some ideals for this. How should they contact you? But then how do you see developing this dialogue, because, you know, we're not going to be able to just sort of jump in there and do it tomorrow. So to sort of say, like, well, you know, I want to be a part of this, but I heard you say that you needed someone with skills in social media. I've got that. How are we going to capture these conversations to make a space for that? How do you see that, and how do you want them to reach out to you to become a part of Critter Camp?
Well, first thing to do, of course, is just reach out to me at JennaBall, one word, one N, at Critican.com. But what I'm hoping to do is when I get enough of the core members, and to me, core members means a variety of people. If it was just you and me and everybody else were authors, that would not be a good mix.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I love authors, but on the other hand, they probably don't have the business skills and all the other things that we're going to need, right? So I am reaching out to community members. I'm reaching out to organizations. I'm reaching out to nonprofits to see who might be interested, right? And once we have a core, what I would call, I guess you would say a board, but I mean, it's really like a group, you know, that is able to start, have these conversations. Where do we want to go with this? How do we want to reach out to educational institutions? Do we want to reach out to educational institutions? Or is it better to just start our own, store and start selling, you know, like Disney or something? You know, I don't know. I have no idea in those terms, but I think that we're going to need people with a variety of experiences and knowledge to start to guide us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we'll all bring something to the table. So that's the first step for me is finding out who's interested. Maybe nobody's going to be interested except you and me, but I kind of doubt it. But anyway, we get some people together who are interested and then see who they know and what they're willing and able to contribute. And then when I feel like I have that core group, I will call a meeting. And if we're lucky enough, we'll be out of quarantine, but if not, we'll do it on Zoom. And we'll talk mm-hmm. about, you know, we'll throw the ideas in the center of the table and we'll talk about it. This is what my vision is. I mean, I don't want things that are outside of the vision, which is, you know, social-emotional learning. I mean, transforming education, being responsible to the planet and one another, and having a sustainable business model that will support everybody. Those are the kind of like the three things that I have to have. But other than that, what are we going to do? What are we going to sell? How are we going to get money? You know, how are we going to organize ourselves? Do we want a board? Do we want a president? So all those things need to be worked out. But I don't want to do any of that until I have people that I know are interested, but also people who are competent. So, I'm working with someone who has a lot of experience with nonprofits and sponsorship at a high level, you know. And so she has some ideas about who she can ask and bring to the table. So if you're interested, you know, just reach out to me and I will add you to the list and keep you informed. And as things move forward, you know, I'll invite you to the table.
Yeah, that sounds good. So, I mean, that sounds good. Like, her email is Jenna Ball, JenaBall, one word,
right.
at CritterFin.com.
Right.
Right. And if someone just wants to, does CritterFin have a website?
Yes. Yeah, so the larger initiative this is all under is Braided Live. So braid, like braiding your hair, braidedlive.com, and then /Critican. And then that will take you to the whole list of, it'll tell you all about Critican. It'll let you listen to each of the dogs in the Critican pack. It'll tell you about the coal. It's really cute. Some actors did these for me. It's just wonderful. Just wonderful. They're just wonderful. So, and then also you can learn about the coalition, a little bit about the coalition, how to reach me, how to sign up for the Critican newsletter, how to get a Critican bracelet. I mean, just all the stuff that, you know, is part of Critican. But mostly
and can
how to stay in touch.
To get the books there too?
Yep, books are there. Classes are there. Swag is there. There are some things that I'm not doing right now. Like I can't do in-person classes, you know.
Yeah.
The schools would pay me to go to Texas and Iowa and all that, but you know, I can't. So that's one thing that's kind of on hold. And I would really, really like to do the international program again. But the problem there is that it was through the schools. So most of the schools are not really up and running yet, you know? So I'm not quite sure how to get everybody together. So, but you know, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
You'll see. There's a lot there for you to consume.
Well, Jenna, thank you again for being back. We're going to revisit one another periodically.
Oh, let's keep talking.
You know, and, you know, and the development of it, you know. And
yeah.
We have other things to talk about. But, you know, this is like an opportunity to plant these seeds. And I recognize it in listening to you talk. And I often tell people, I said, well, what's something that you've done that's really good? And I tell them, like, 30 years ago, I was part of this coalition that started a youth program. And to see where some of those young people are now making a difference from
some of the things
we put in there, I mean, that is just, like, amazing. And that's what
Critter
gold. This is the time for Critterkin in part. You know, technology where we can reach people. I mean, you wouldn't have all, you know, you're in a Twitter group with all of these teachers. I mean, we wouldn't have it if technology hadn't developed. So this is a time that we
take
and do something meaningful with it.
Yes, yes. We have the technology to do it now. Isn't that amazing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and bring all pieces from across the country, you know, because nothing says that whoever's going to do the accounting and whoever is going to do the marketing both have to be in the same place. One can be, you know, all
over the world. Of course not, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I would like to do maybe down the road in a few weeks is see if we can have a three-way conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever do that? Because I would like to bring, because it would be really interesting to me, or even a four-way conversation, it might be too much, but three-way for sure, you know, just to bring, for example, someone who is part of the International SPCA, or bring some, because I've worked with them, or the World Wildlife Federation, or how about Big Brothers and Big Sisters, or, you know, groups that work with children with with a goal of doing this kind of thing, you know, where might Critikin fit with them, and how might we work with them to make it a reality? One of my dreams was to, with my local SPCA, was to give them a copy, as many as they needed, a copy of my very first book that they could give to everybody who adopted a dog. So that the reason being, it's a very short book, but it just teaches basic stuff about what dogs need and, you know, the love they feel, and they're not like people, you know, you have to be patient and that kind of thing. So, but they just, I mean, they just didn't have a system for doing it. I was donating the books, and they just didn't have the system in place to do it. So, anyway, I mean, things like that always surprise me, the things that stop organizations from doing something that could be wonderful. You know, it's some bureaucratic blah, 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 or we don't have the space to put the books, or whatever the thing is, you know, there's always something. You know, so to be able to talk with those organizations and discuss the potential challenges and potential solutions and what wonderful things we might be able to do would be really wonderful.
That's an excellent idea. That is an excellent idea that we are going to follow up on.
Let's do that. And we should probably get on, like, you and I should go on a Twitter chat and get into, like, there's a chat called Parent-Teacher Chat, which is always great. There's Educator Chat. There's Son Chat. There are hundreds. Let me just say that. There's hundreds of education chats. But it's really good to become known there because the educators are from around the world. So maybe you meet somebody from Argentina, you know, or, you know, Xiaoming, she comes in from China. I mean, so I just think it's really healthy for people to get to know each other in that format. Because no pressure, right?
No, and for us to think about it, because, you know, I have a friend who's, they have been in the military, and they have moved around. And her son wrote a book about moving. And it just
happened
that he was working, he was going to move, and he shared the book with someone who had a moving company. And what they did, I mean, they clicked, and he told them about it and told them what his thoughts were. And pretty soon, this company who worked for this corporate, moved most of the people from the corporation, when they gave them this package, you know, these are things to think about when you move, they included this children's book.
So cool.
And so maybe, you know, we're going to talk after, you know, we might brainstorm and something might come up and we'll go like, And, you know, not the suspect that we're thinking, but might be that person, you know, who does something like, I like the SPCA thing. So every time you get a dog, you see this. And so, you know, those are deals. So we're going to do that.
I'm telling you, we're going to take over the world with kindness.
Yes, we are.
I want to thank my guest, the founder and creative director of Critikin, Jenna Ball. It takes a global community to raise our kids. That community needs to be composed of creative professionals, educators, parents, and a community that understands education as a lived experience extending far beyond the classroom. Be sure and follow Collections by Michelle Brown Blog Radio on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And let us know if you have a suggestion for a guest or topic for a future show. You can listen to this or past episodes of the show on SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, or Blog Talk Radio. Join us next week when I'll introduce you to another amazing individual living between the lines, standing boldly in the crosshairs of their intersectionality and creating change right here on Collections by Michelle Brown. Thank you for listening.